You're listening to the Metamore City Podcast, special episode number 9, Feedback Show episode 4, continued.
Woohoo!
Metamore City, a podcast series created by Chris Lester. For more information, please visit www.metamorecity.com.
Hey there, folks. We are back. This is Chris Lester.
This is Kitty Nakian.
This is Gail Carriger.
And this is J. Daniel Sawyer.
And we are continuing our feedback show madness.
Woohoo!
So we have a few emails left to read, and then we're going to get into some voicemail.
Nope. I get to go first this time.
Go for it.
Dan keeps trying to steal the lead. This is from Marcy. I've been listening to Metamore City since the beginning and following you on Twitter for some time. Last night you made a Twitter comment about transformational literature and your personal history with it. And I said, in my own way, I did become someone else, which I guess piqued your curiosity. It's pretty simple, really. I am a transsexual. I had gender reassignment surgery about 9 years ago. This puts me in the position of living about half of my adult life, so far, as a man, and half as a woman. I don't claim to be an expert on gender, men or women. I have been delighted with your portrayal of all of them. I don't know how much my experiences resemble those of a genetic female or non-transsexual genetic male. I just see things from my perspective. From my perspective, nothing in Metamore City grates. The men seem to be real men, the women real women.
And the little furry creatures from Alpha Centauri are real small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri.
And Marcy, we love you.
And we were happy about it.
We are true geeks here.
And the androgynes as composed or confused as people in my state can be. You've had some absolutely stellar scenes, and much as some people wonder about your poly background, I am poly myself and was surprised when I found you were not. I wonder about your gender issues. I'm sure there are few men alive who haven't wanted to know what it's like to be a woman and vice versa. Yeah, I really envy the peeing standing up thing, let me just say. I have no shame in admitting. Pure envy. But you seem to have a special sort of grip on gender and how it's perceived.
Oh, thank you very much, Marcy. It means a lot to me, especially coming from the perspective of someone who has seen both sides of the fence, as it were. It really encourages me to know that you think that I'm doing a good job of capturing the characters. It's definitely important to me to make sure that all of my characters are as real and as believable in representing their gender as I can make them.
Can we do this anthropological thing for a second?
Yeah.
Sure.
This is one of those things that had me tweet screaming at one of the previous, I can't remember whose feedback show it was, but there's a difference between, at least so far as the anthropologists are concerned, gender and biological sex.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We totally agree.
And biological sex being...
Yeah, that was actually a voicemail you sent me. You called my phone.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, I'm listening to the Metamore City feedback show and I want to scream at you!
You guys were very drunk at that point, I think.
And I listened back and I'm like, wait, did I say that? And I listened back and I sit there and I go to all the trouble of saying there's a distinction. And then I go and confuse the terms for the rest of the episode. I felt like such a moron.
Yeah.
This is what you get when you code switch.
Yeah.
It is true. I mean, there is a spectrum of biological sex, and there's a spectrum of psychological gender and sociological gender. And the two are not always correlated.
Mm-hmm. And our culture doesn't
and there are numerous,
have the categories for it.
There mm-hmm. are also numerous instances of cultures with third genders or with another mm-hmm. gender.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
That is sometimes biologically distinguished and sometimes not mm-hmm. as much. So,
yeah, it's one of those things that I kind of looked back on in retrospect and realized how even though intellectually I know that these diversities exist in both sex and gender, that in a large extent, my own thinking was still being shaped by the categories, the dichotomies of male versus female.
English doesn't have a good linguistic facilities to deal with it.
It's not
like Elizabeth Pisani's book, The Wisdom of Horace. She spends several chapters on her years in Jakarta working with the Waria, which is an Indonesian term, meaning, there's no direct translation, but it means, you know...
Not man, not woman,
yeah. Something like that.
Like the hira, I think it's hira, I think that's how it's pronounced in India.
Really? Mm-hmm. But she kept a lot of notes because she was working for UNAIDS and doing the AIDS survey work there. So she kept a lot of notes on how she came to understand what the Wadia were and how they perceived themselves and how they worked in the culture. And she layers that all into the book, and it's really cool.
Yeah, it is difficult in English because we don't really have the facility in our language to talk about a third gender.
Mm-hmm. We even lost the neuter conjugation for nouns.
It's not really even 1, 2, 3. It is a whole spectrum and with lots of intermediates. And yeah, I don't know that there is any society that has an ability to really recognize the true diversity of what goes on in how our XY chromosomes are expressed and how the psychology of gender identity expresses itself.
I think the next 20 and 30 years are going to be really interesting on that score.
I think without the ability to type your genetic identity, you really can only identify true male, true female, and something in between.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, well, for a long time there, we didn't have the sort of genetic research or genetic ability to understand that there was this sort of shades of gray. There was certainly the psychological shades of gray were always in place.
But yeah, even now we don't really understand exactly what
the interplay is.
Yeah, what combination of genetic and environmental factors results in the various intersex conditions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have no idea of how that relates to how people's psychology develops. It's a big fuzzy area of biology.
Yeah. It's one of those human category things where we do like to have it black or white, one or the other, you know, male or female.
I blame modernism to a large extent for that, because the whole modernist school of thought is about putting things in boxes.
That's pretty common to, I mean, if you read ancient literature, say, read Deuteronomy and the taxonomies that just go all through there, or surviving ancient literature from anywhere in the Near East, which is what I'm most familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Even the ancient Greeks.
In the ancient Greeks
had that whole mythos about two separate.
Yeah, and humans are categorizing animals. We categorize things extensively in order to order our universe around us.
But one of the big differences between the West and the East is that in the West you see a lot more of either or, and in the East you see a lot more of both and.
Yes.
You know, the Indian and Far Eastern cultures are much more comfortable with concepts that embrace paradoxes, that embrace the coexistent tension of two dichotomous ideas.
They do philosophically, but I've always
in
found
practice.
It, yeah, in practice, it's a whole different story. The caste system in India is a good example, or the dualistic stratification of Tibetan society up until the Chinese invasion. Mm. You had the priests and the slaves, and that was it.
It's because category and organization is a means for control.
Yes.
If you define something, then you can dominate it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Moving on?
Yes.
Thoughtful stuff. Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts, Marcy.
Is there more
it's great to hear from
more
you.
More Marcy's email?
No, Marcy's done.
Cool.
Okay.
And following up on the androgyne theme, androgynes and their period.
Oh, no.
Someone whose name I can't pronounce.
Let me see.
Feline...
Yeah, that's Feline Trinka. That's Trinka, the same Feline from Austria who's been emailing us back for a while.
From Feline Trinka. Hi, Chris, and probably Dan and Kitty, too.
And Gail.
And Gail. It's me again, this time with a real question, not only fan mail and man love requests.
Oh, that Feline.
Yeah, that Feline.
I could not agree more.
Feline,
man
we love you.
Man love is necessary.
Absolutely.
Perhaps even vital.
Says the woman with like 2 zillion gay characters in a forthcoming novel.
So I won't be asking you how being pregnant works for Metamore City's androgynes. I will, however, ask you how their period works. Doesn't constantly changing gender mess with one's hormonal balance? Do androgynes get their period more irregularly than normal human females? Yeah. Or can they just switch to male for a few days until it's over and thus bypass the nuisance of getting their period? Or would this only delay the period until they switch back? What happens when an androgyne switches from female to male during her period?
I am really confused about this, but I am confident that you have thought about this and can present me with a satisfying answer.
Could you change to male just so you could pee standing up, for example?
Still loving your story and feeling kind of sad that it's going to end soon. Feline.
I would like to interrupt and say that that would be one reason I would definitely change gender. Oh my god.
Not having to deal with the period.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It would be awesome.
I really appreciate the level of confidence that you have, Feline, and the extent to which I've thought things through. In this case, you are right. I did think this through. One of these days, you guys are going to get me with one of these off-the-wall questions. But no, this is one that I did think about. The basic function of the period is to regenerate and recondition the uterine lining to make sure that it is ready to receive a zygote again.
He's going biological, ladies and gentlemen.
Of course I'm going biological. So that is its primary function. Therefore, the reason why the period has to happen is if the uterine lining has been around and in existence long enough for it to have deteriorated and to need regeneration. Whenever any of the cursed individuals of Metamore change shape, there is some auto-healing that happens, some regeneration of tissue that takes place as things are shifted around and as tissues are repurposed to fit the new organs that are being put into place.
Well, that's a handy byproduct.
It is. It's a very handy byproduct. So an androgyne female who stays female will go through the same normal 28-day cycle as any other woman. However, once she changes to male and then changes back again, her uterine lining regenerates to the condition that it would be right after the period is finished, where the uterine lining is in its ideal regenerated state. It's ready to receive a zygote. She then still has to go through the same hormonal cycle that results in ovulation. So she's not fertile right away, but the period does not have to happen as long as she is changing regularly enough that her body is regenerating that uterine lining through the shape-shifting process.
Handy.
Yeah.
So you got both peeing standing up and no period.
I'm taking the curse.
Oh, definitely.
The downside, of course, is that if you are female and then take the curse to become male, you have to spend at least half of your time in your male form, which then means that you, for all practical purposes, cannot become pregnant. So if that matters to you,
wonderful reason to take the curse.
If that matters to you, then that is a reason not to to go through with getting the curse.
I think that sounds like a fabulous
Well, thing. Since I'm
well, you certainly cut down on birth control costs that way.
Yes, definitely. The androgynes have a very...
Can they self-abort that way?
They can. There are some possible health problems if they wait too long, but for practical purposes, if you shapeshift within 12, 24 hours after sex, there is no implantation that's ever going to happen.
Nice! So,
yeah, it is a very nice built-in birth control method that the androgynes have.
Does this heal, sort of intrinsic healing that couples with the change also affect viral and bacterial infections?
It doesn't affect viral and bacterial things because those are sort of systemic. They're still in the blood when the person shifts. It can help with gross structural damage like lacerations and trauma. Really severe injuries are not going to be corrected by it, at least not completely, but it can sometimes make a difference in stabilizing someone if they are in well enough condition that they can actually shift.
I was about to ask that. Can they shift when they're badly injured?
Yeah, if you're too badly injured, then you're going to have a hard time focusing the personal energy and willpower necessary to shapeshift. So not a good solution for crisis ER situations, but for minor cuts and bruises and such, it's quite handy.
Okay, I'm going to read Patty Heaney's question.
Patty, yay!
Patty!
Okay, this is Patty, and she sent this on March 17th. With St. Me Day happening, I figured... We love you, Patty.
Oh, dear.
I figured I'd send a slightly less drunk message to go with my slightly more drunken voicemail. Okay, I don't get that. You're sending a less drunk message on St. Patrick's Day? What are you?
Apparently not Irish.
Exactly. So here goes. If the Psy Collective is so bent on continuation of the species, wouldn't it be more in their best interest to encourage low-powered men to mate with mundane women, at least those men who can do so?
They do. When the individual is low-powered enough that they can interbreed. In terms of the power rating system that the collective uses, a person with a telepathy level of 1 or lower is going to have weak enough psi that they're not going to risk their partner getting caught in a gestalt if they have a sex with a mundane. That's the category that Jared falls into. Daniel is a 2, so he is right in that unfortunate no man's land of not being weak enough to actually breed with Mundies and not being strong enough to be considered to be useful to the collective.
Also, what happens to women who are rendered unable to bear children due to illness or injury? If a Psy woman had some problem that made her eggs non-viable after she was considered sexually mature, but before she could have children, what would they do with her?
That is an interesting question, isn't it? It would certainly be seen as a great tragedy, particularly if the individual had a very strong talent and they were then rendered non-reproductive. The loss would be felt very deeply by the hive. They would still take care of her, just as they care for all of their members. But she would probably find herself being placed into a situation where she was either engaged in some kind of nursemaiding role, maybe working as one of the teachers at the creche, some sort of support role.
Why not becoming an agent like Victor? If she's strong enough.
If she has the power for that and she wants to, then that would certainly be an avenue that would be open to her. The military intelligence directorate does not discriminate on the basis of gender. And they do have some very powerful female operatives like Fiona, who have had very successful careers there. But because of the psychology of the collective and the fact that they sort of see MID services, this tour of duty that the strongest of them have to do, and then they get to get out of it and go and have a family, I think that the loss would probably be very keenly felt. And some of them may decide to cope with that loss by staying in the military where they didn't have to deal with the family structure. And some of them may decide to become part of the hive society to whatever degree that they can by serving in the creches. It would probably depend on the individual psychology.
Okay. I want to add one question of my own.
Sure.
in between here. Something that's been niggling me on the whole Psy Collective breeding cell thing. Mm-hmm. Is that you've set up a social structure here where basically the men are valued for their abilities and the women are valued for their wombs.
Mm, you're right. It's not an equitable situation. Mm-hmm. Women are valued regardless of their ability level. Individuals who have strong abilities and are female are like the golden jewels of the collective. You know, an individual like Miriam Bakhtavar, there is mm-hmm. a reason why she was looked on with such prestige. You know, she had such prestige and such cachet within the collective society because she was both strong and accomplished as an individual, and because she'd had the ability to pass on her genes to the next generation. But it is definitely a discriminatory setup mm-hmm. that has its cost for both men and women.
The Psy Collective really is based on the church you grew up in, isn't it?
Subconsciously, mostly. It's partly based on that, and it's partly based on a model that I had heard advanced for the way that a human colony would be able to reproduce itself as quickly as possible on an alien world. Mm.
Is that the social dynamics you were just describing? Sound very familiar, very similar to the churches I grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are definitely some similarities. I think that the collective values women's minds and their capabilities far more than some of the traditional evangelical churches. Mm-hmm. Because the collective certainly does not expect its women folk to stay at home and do nothing. You know, you've got characters like Sasha and Fiona who go out there and are on the front lines and are mm-hmm. widely respected for it. And leaders like Miriam who are valued as leaders and mm-hmm. are looked upon with great reverence because of that.
But why would you risk them? I'm sorry, but if your entire sort of objective is procreation and well, continuation of species, why do you put your most powerful females on the front lines?
Well, why do you risk any of your powerful young people?
It seems to me you would want to breed them first and then risk them.
That is an ongoing controversy within the collective. The reason why it's set up the way that it is because the military does not want old individuals who are set in their ways who have a lot to lose. They want people who have as few attachments as possible so that there is as little that the enemy can hold over them as possible. You know, you don't want to take as your agent somebody who has to worry about surviving to come home to their family. You want somebody who is able to put themselves in exceedingly risky situations and come through it and be a little bit reckless, a little bit mercenary with their own lives. And so it's this conflict of interest between the needs of the military and the needs of the collective. And the collective has compromised on this and allows the military to take their best and their brightest right out of the academy and shape them into the weapons that they need them to be, because that is what keeps the alliance going between the collective and the empire, which the collective strongly depends upon in order to ensure their ongoing survival. Because they know that if the humans ever turn against them, that they want the government of the most powerful nation on Earth to be on their side.
Do they at least do gamete farming in vitro?
They do. They take they do take sperm samples and egg samples from, you know, the Victor himself has made mention.
From the most powerful before they're sent out to the front lines. Oh, good.
Yeah.
That makes a bit more sense.
Yes.
Okay, continuing on with Patty's comments, sorry to interrupt you, Patty. On a slightly darker note, I am not sure Rebecca's motivations for forsaking Daniel were quite as selfless as you implied in the second part of the feedback episode. I have no doubt that she really is dedicated, but she also expressed a want for children from a very young age. She may love Daniel, but having kids is never an easy proposition. Getting along with the collective afforded her medical care, child care, and a source of income for life, something that going off with Daniel wouldn't. I'm fully able to believe that she's a very nice chick, but I also have to believe that the collective serves her best interests in a very big way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I can't argue with that at all. And certainly what Rebecca tells herself in order to feel like she accepts her position and her choice, and what is motivating her on a subconscious level may not be the same things. So yeah, you make some excellent points, and I'm sure that those things were factored into the decision, at least on a subconscious level for her.
And one final comment, being in touch with your feminine side is not the same as touching your feminine side. Just an FYI.
Oh dear.
I think we are veering into the slightly drunk category.
Thank you, Patty. Very good thoughts, and thanks for sending them in before you got yourself liquored up.
Just wait till we get to my feedback show.
Oh, boy.
It was several drinks later.
All right, I've got the last email here. It's from Abby Hilton.
Yay,
Abby!
And it's a multi-parter, guys, so okay. Get ready. She says, hey, Chris and Dan, a couple of points I wanted to make. One, failure to pass on genes does not equal to failure to pass on yourself. You, Chris, are passing on ideas and stories, although you do not seem to be making an effort to pass on genes. Without ever breeding, we can pass on ideas, inventions, art, books, science, all kinds of things that change the world and leave a mark and effect on people's minds forever. A woman who maximizes her reproductive opportunities rarely has the time or space to give those kinds of gifts to the world. Men also damage their chances of creating these things by taking on large amounts of child-rearing responsibilities. As you've pointed out, environment can be as important as genetics in shaping people. Many people who don't breed get to spend more time shaping the environment in which other people's kids grow up.
That's
by,
right.
For example, becoming teachers. And that was me.
Yeah, I make no disagreement with any of that. You raised some excellent points, Abby.
Yeah, the conversation that she's referencing was the one where you and I started going back and forth on the relative value of genetics versus memetics as a form of personal heredity.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. I mean,
you being the biologist wound up like genetics, but I mean the other stuff's important too, and I being the humanities nut, I'm like, you know, the genetics are important, but fuck them, memetics are the important part.
It's an ongoing tension that we have within human thought, because we are these biological organisms with these incredible brains, and we are capable of passing on portions of ourselves and our self-identity in this cultural transmission that is completely separate from our genetic transmission of ourselves. And it's really unique, I think, within the animal kingdom. I
know if other animals have culture, but I don't know of any other animals who have culture that shape their biological evolution.
Other animals have socialization.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, there's socialization.
I think the definition of culture is a human construct. Well,
and I suppose it depends on how you define it, but like beavers, for example, the know-how to build a beaver dam is something that's passed on mimetically through the generations. It's not an inborn instinct. It's an
acquired. Do we know that?
Yeah.
Okay. So if they take a neonate beaver and it's never exposed to other beavers, that it won't know how to build a dam?
It won't. It'll fell trees and stick them in the water, but it won't know what it's doing.
Ah.
Whereas
sorry, that's so sad.
Mm-hmm. But you compare that to a wasp.
But that's still not beaver culture. Mm-hmm.
Again,
says the anthropologist.
Okay, it depends on how you're defining culture and which philosopher's definition of culture you're following.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using the definition of culture as know-how and social structure that's passed non-genetically,
mm-hmm.
Vertically and horizontally,
mm-hmm.
not just mm-hmm. you know, language and things like that, but other things like how to make a fire, how to make a dam, you know.
There are also, like, for example, killer whales or sea otters. Mm-hmm. The mothers teach the offspring how to hunt specific kinds of prey. And the kinds of prey that they learn how to hunt are very specific to either the particular pattern of hunting behavior that the sea otter uses or the particular hunting pattern that that pod uses. But the problem in animal species other than humans is that the cultural transmission, the sociological transmission of behaviors is so tightly intertwined with the genetic transmission because they're only transmitting to closely knit family groups. You know, the matriarch of a pod of killer whales is only going to teach hunting techniques to other individuals within its pod,
right,
who are all closely related. So separating out the cultural versus the mimetic versus the genetic.
You take experiments where you remove a baby from one and drop it in the other and that sort of thing.
And so it becomes very difficult to separate out those factors. And so for practical purposes, when you're looking at the survival of a particular population, you can look at it almost as a purely genetic thing because any resulting mimetic factors are so tightly intertwined with the genetic factors that the population is going to live and die based upon what's going on with that particular group.
I'm just going to say that Chris has his biological determinist hat on again.
I was going to say that humans are different. That we are extraordinarily different from that because we have this worldwide communication. We have this sharing of cultural ideas that goes back to, you know, for as long as we've had civilization, as long as we've had writing or oral history, that we are able to pass on ideas through language and communicate them to people we are not closely related to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a really unique and extraordinary event in the history of evolution. And I don't think we really have a grasp yet of what its long-term implications are.
But there's some wonderful things it's done for us so far.
So did you have anything to add to that, Gail? I know that you were kind of like bouncing in your seat there, getting ready to say something.
No, I don't. I think it's all been said. Okay. I don't think I want to enter the cultural argument fray at this juncture in my academic career. I'll leave it.
So, yes, I'm not disagreeing with anything you said, Abby. You're making some excellent points, and I don't have anything in any opposition to them.
Well, she goes on to say, I'm guessing that nearly everyone listening to this podcast is making that choice on some level. How many people out there are truly maximizing their reproductive capabilities? Even people with families aren't having as many kids as possible,
mm-hmm.
unless they're Mormon. We are
or Catholic.
Yes, or Catholic. We are creative as well as procreative, and that creativity can be either part of our legacy or our whole legacy. Mm-hmm. Second point is, I remember listening to you struggle to respond to another woman offended by Eva's How to Be a Girl lecture. I didn't like that lecture either, but I thought, this is a set of assumptions shared by many men and women. Having a character who thinks these things and a budding woman who finds them useful is not unrealistic. I listened to you defend Eva and thought, wrong answer, Chris. You don't have to own your character's ideas. If you don't want to paint yourself into corners, this is all you need to say. Eva is not me. She is not my mouthpiece. She is a character whom I have attempted to make believable and internally consistent. But she has her own set of assumptions, half-truths, mistakes, and prejudices. Her views are a product of her culture, personality, upbringing, and so on. Her assumptions may or may not be true, but that's not important. The important thing is that her personality and her opinions are believable, that she is a knowable person.
Excellent point, Abby, and I really like the way that you wrote that. Yeah, none of my characters are ever consistently my mouthpiece. Sometimes I find them saying things that I happen to agree with to a great degree, and sometimes not. It really depends upon the situation, and usually the points where I might be able to recognize author on board happen in retrospect, and they happen subconsciously, like where Evan is saying, you know, when he remarks to Daniel about how if you're a member of a warlike society, then you're going to continue being dragged into conflict with other people, whether you want to or not, because you believe that that's the only viable solution. And that's something that I very strongly believe. And it's not something that, you know, I set out at the beginning and said, okay, in this chapter, Evan is going to give my moral of the story for, you know, or my big moral message here. It just happened that in the course of the conversation, he said something and it's like, oh yeah, I really agree with that.
Do you ever find that the opposite happens? That you have a character that kind of goes off on the character's own little tangent that's completely opposite to what you would believe or think?
Certainly when I'm writing for Victor.
Here's a question for you.
My good guys do that.
Here's a question for you. Do you have characters that you like and sympathize with that go off in directions that you don't like or agree with?
I definitely have characters I like who I don't agree with all the time. Mm-hmm. The Psy Collective is a great example of that. There are a lot of characters in the Psy Collective. Their values as a society, I think, are out of whack and are disproportionately applied. I can see the value in them and I understand why they hold them, but I think that they have some very unhealthy, very negative consequences, but I still like them and I still want to see them succeed and to become happy and healthy people. Part of that is going to require them to look at their views and reconsider. I mean, if you have a character who goes through an entire story and they never question their worldview, how can you? They haven't really grown very much by the end of the story. It was once described to me, the Dramatica theory of story, which I really like, says that all stories can be basically boiled down to one scenario. A character is going along a certain path. Somebody stands in their way and says, don't go that way, go this way instead. And that the character then has to make the decision of whether to proceed in the direction that they were going or to stop, change their perspective, and go in a different direction. And that question, and the question of whether or not it's a happy ending or a sad ending, depends upon what choice they make and whether they made the right choice in the author's view or the wrong choice. And it's a very useful model for storytelling that I've used a lot when I was developing Making the Cut. And some of my characters have to remain steadfast in their beliefs, and sometimes they have to stop and consider and change the way that they're doing things.
Okay, continuing on with Abby's email. Finally, and her third point is, this idea that women are intrinsically, perhaps even primarily, valuable for their uteruses, or their femininity, or their looks, or any other trait that they were born with and didn't work for or create. There is something deeply depressing about being valued primarily for things that we do not value in ourselves, and having our greatest achievements overlooked in favor of something we never chose, cultivated, or even wanted. Telling girls that they are primarily valuable as procreators, not as creators, this is poisonous. I don't think that's actually what you believe or what you meant, but you come close enough to it that I wanted to respond. As Kim said, if your story wasn't so good, it wouldn't be worth all of this typing.
Well, thank you, Abby. And yeah, that is the danger, and that is the trouble. One of the big problems with the Psy Collective's approach to things. And you're right, I don't agree with that. And I do think that that is one of the big negative consequences of the obsession that they have with their own survival as a new breed of humanity. It is, to some extent, dehumanizing them, and that it's causing them to emphasize aspects of, as individuals, aspects of self-worth that they don't have any control over. And that is, it is a negative and destructive thing in the long run. And I think that if the collective does not change its perspective on things, if they don't adjust their value system, that they're going to be headed for some heartache and probably continue to run into conflicts with the people around them.
Okay, so up for voicemail?
Yeah, let's take a quick break here.
Voicemail,
and then we will come back and play the voicemails.
My name is Tristan Johnson, and on YouTube, my username is TristanPEJ. On that channel, I garnered a little bit of celebrity status talking about things like atheism, skepticism, religion, debate, anarchy, communism, all different topics that mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. I talk about philosophy, I talk about logic, I talk about transhumanism, but here things are changing. I'm starting up a podcast. I'm probably going to have it going every week. And I'm going to start on April 27th. I'm going to have co-hosts. I'm going to have news. I'm going to have in-depth discussions that you can't have on YouTube. If you want to get in on the discussion, go to TristanPEJ.com or email me at TristanPEJ@gmail.com and ask me questions, comments, get the ball going. If you want to join the conversation, the time is now. The Universe of Tristan podcast is starting up again, and I want you. Go to TristanPEJ.com and sign up for the RSS feed. Follow the podcast. Get involved. Get ready. April 27th, the Universe of Tristan podcast starts again.